and This Worldly Piety and the Islamic Revival by Francis Robinson, Professor of History at the University of London, on Monday, January 31st at 4 p.m. at the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus. For more information, go to www.cas.uiuc.edu.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the program today, we'll be talking about Nepal. For most of its history, the country of Nepal has been ruled by a hereditary monarchy, and that also includes the present, the past few years, even though the country has been making some lurching so far incomplete steps toward democracy. Since 1996, a Maoist insurgency in the country has been waging war against the monarchy, and more than 10,000 people have been killed. People who follow this conflict say that at least to date, neither side, the government nor the Maoists, have enough military force to prevail. However, it also seems to be true that in recent years, the military power of the insurgency has been growing. This is a conflict that has not gotten very much attention outside of the region. But, again, people who have followed it say that it has great potential not only to devastate Nepal, but also to spread into neighboring countries. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about Nepal's civil war with Sudhir Mahara. Let me tell you a little bit about him. First of all, he was born in Nepal and educated there. He also is educated in Britain and the United States. He attended Sandhurst, the Royal Military Academy, and also Georgetown University, where he picked up a master's degree in security and strategic studies. He has served in the Royal Nepalese Army. His most recent position was as senior instructor in the peacekeeping training center of the Nepalese Army. He also is now currently scholar in residence at the Center for International Security Law at the University of Virginia School of Law, and also works for the military consulting firm of Blue Force LLC. We talk this morning with Sudhir Mahara, you certainly should feel free to be a part of the conversation. Questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of people who call in is that they just try to keep their comments and questions brief so that we can keep our program moving and get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, anybody's welcome to call. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. So that is 800-222-9455. So, again, locally, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana folks. And anybody else around Illinois, Indiana, even if you're listening on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, that number is 800-222-9455. Sudhir Mahara, hello.
Hello, David.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
We certainly appreciate it. I think to begin, I would expect that a lot of people listening to us won't know very much about Nepal and may even only have a vague idea where it is. Just to start, tell us a few basic things. What should people know to start about Nepal?
Well, David, I think to start with, the good, which most people around the world know about, a beautiful mountainous country known more for trekking, and the beautiful Himalayas, very friendly people, serviced in the British Army since the early 1800s. These are things come to mind. But since 1996, as you mentioned in your introduction, it's been ravaged by a bloody insurgency. And it's a country that is facing the typical problems present in a transitioning democracy. That side is less known and has received less international attention and response. Again, thank you for giving airtime to the Nepal issue.
Mm. Well, I think, this is something that we, in our programming over the years, have tried to do, and that is talk about things that people, we think they should at least know something about. But don't get a lot of attention in popular media and otherwise might not have heard about it. And I think this is certainly a good example for the reasons I just touched on, not only because this conflict has the potential really to devastate the country, but it does have potential consequences for the region because of the place that it is. Well, let me ask you this question. Talk a little bit about the monarchy and about attempts to institute democracy, because certainly people have been critical of the monarchy. There was an opportunity or an attempt to introduce multi-party politics in the late 50s, which was then swept aside by the king at that time. Then in the early 90s, democratic politics came in again, but again in 2002, that was swept away by the king. And there continues to be a lot of conflict even today between the legislature and the king, even though it continues to be a different king. Has the monarchy somehow failed, do you think, in a responsibility to try to move the country toward democracy?
I wouldn't characterize it as the monarchy having failed. Rather, has it been given the chance to succeed? You can play with words in Donald Rumsfeld style any which way. But the truth of the matter is, Nepal has been traditionally a monarchy since its inception as a state, and that has been without putting any judgment, whether good or bad, its political culture. In the 60s, there was an attempt at multi-party democracy by the king, or the father of the present king. It had its successes and failures. And like you mentioned, in 1990, a multi-party democracy, a transition which was not bloody at all, really. There was a mass uprising and call for multi-party democracy, and which was pretty much handed over by the king. And then again, like you mentioned, in 2002, it reverted back to a, although it is still a parliamentary democracy, the monarch rules through an Article 124 or a constitutional provision, which is again debated from both sides as legitimate or illegitimate. To speak on the monarchy side, it has. It characterizes its response as the multi-party, the Maoist crisis coming on the national scene, and the democracy or multi-party democracy and government response was unable to respond to it, and it saw upon itself as to respond, because no response was coming from any quarter. When it began, it received support both domestically and internationally, at least in word. And that support over time, until today, since 2002, is eroding rapidly. For various reasons, for failures, for some instances of human rights, but which all has, as I would see it, typical problems faced in any transitional democracy and any weak state trying to respond to a serious crisis.
Mm. Well, that leads to the question of just what is the relationship between the difficulties the country has had in moving toward multi-party democracy and the insurgency. And one wonders whether, given the kind of difficulties it seems that people have had in trying to put together this functioning multi-party democracy and working with one another, whether that would be happening even if there was no insurgency. And can you really blame the failure of the movement towards democracy on the insurgency? Or maybe the better way to ask the question is, well, what relationship is there between the two?
What you mentioned is right on the line. it is a problem not only, you know, really of whether who's ruling or who holds political power. There is, you know, at this time, divided the power, you know, including certain power being exercised by the Maoist rebels themselves, the government or the royal palace, and then the multi-party, various multi-party representatives, which also hold a certain degree of power, political power, that is. And it is a typical, you know, going back to the causes, it goes back to, and then there has been various theorists that study internal conflict and civil wars, and you know, various theories come to mind. Some point to resources, relative deprivation, lack of leadership, and some you know, my favorite in this is really it's about a weak state. I think, you know, when the state is weak, and the state is weak for various reasons, for lack of resources, for lack of trained manpower, and these are the problems really that are at the root cause for the crises, and the relationship overlaps in each sector. So there, I think that there's plenty of blame to go around here.
Well, this did begin as a rural movement. And it is true that Nepal overall is one of the poorest countries in the world. Can one say that what government there is and the monarchy, it somehow failed in doing what could be done to develop the rural areas of the country?
Again, yes. But, I mean, just to give you and the audience a perception of resource constraint. You know, you are looking at a country that has 24 million people, you know, the size, mostly the size of North Carolina, you know, which apparently has about, you know, 6-7 million population. Now, if you look at the territory of Nepal, you know, one-third is the Himalayas. It's inhabitable. And then you have the Terai, which is the low jungles, and then the mid-hills. About 60-70% of the population are actually merged or concentrated in the mid-hills and Tarai region. Lest the point be lost, you're looking 16 million people sandwiched into one-third of North Carolina. And then, you know, if you look at, again, the same thing, the gross domestic product, you're looking at $5.5 billion, you know. Compare that to the 2003 public schools budget for Fairfax County, you know, which had a $1.3 billion budget. So you know, this is a severe resource shortage. So it doesn't matter whether who's in power, you know, or who's. It's really about the leadership being able to lead the population into transformation towards economic betterment. You know, as one U.S. diplomat put it, at this stage, you know, the country or a house is in fire, and the fight between the parties is about who gets the master bedroom.
Well, we have a couple of callers to bring into the conversation. Let us do that. Also, perhaps I should introduce again the guest for this part of Focus 580, Sudhir Mahara. He is scholar in residence at the Center for National Security Law at the University of Virginia School of Law. Is particularly interested in Nepal. Is Nepali himself. Has lectured on that subject and also about South Asia at the U.S. Department of State Foreign Service Institute's Advanced Foreign Area Studies Program, also has served in the Royal Nepalese Army, and also was consultant to the International Justice Mission and its anti-human trafficking project in India. That was back in 2001. Questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We do have callers here. We'll start with line one and someone listening this morning in Champaign. Hello.
Hello. I just wanted to know... Where does this Maoist insurgency come from? I guess David said that it was a rural thing, so I don't know if there are a lot of intellectuals involved. It seems that China is moving away from Maoism, so I was just wondering how it got developed. And what is the ideology of a Maoist insurgency in the 21st century? What is their ideology? What do they want?
Thank you. Yes, you know, the Maoist insurgency, you know, to a Western viewer, is an oxymoron of a sort. Where it started, the insurgency in latent form in Nepal has existed for the past 4 or 5 decades, but they never really burst out in the open for lack of popular support and the ability to do so. Until 1996 is when, you know, formally when the Communist Party of Nepal, the Maoists, the most radical offshoot of the left-wing spectrum in Nepali politics, broke into armed rebellion is when Maoist insurgency came. It started in far western Nepal. If you look at the Nepali map, in an area called Rolpa Rukum, which is one of the most backward areas in the countries. It modeled itself in the Maoist insurgency of Mao, though how it's progressed, it's copied various forms of the Maoist doctrine, from the Senderos Luminous Shining Path in Peru to the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia.
Okay. And what is Nepal doing to respond to charges of human rights abuse among its prisoners, insurgents that have been in prison, such as rape of women prisoners and other charges? That they, you know, how can they treat these prisoners better than they have been? It seems like it's maybe on the order of Abu Ghraib or something.
I wouldn't quite characterize it as Abu Ghraib. You know, it is apples and oranges we're comparing for this reason. You know, the human rights has been a thorny issue in the government's response to the Maoist insurgency, yes. And there is evidence of a great deal of human rights abuses. But in, you know, again, in defense of the weak government of Nepal, it's like blaming a dog for not, or rather, for blaming a cat for not barking. You know, in order to avoid or to adhere to a lot of international human rights standards, the government does require a certain degree of resources to be able to do so in terms of, you know, the technical, the know-how, awareness of the facts to its trained, to training for its people who execute its counterinsurgency operations, to really the sophisticated, you know, equipment to be able to process people accused of criminal activities against the state. When that is missing, you know, groups on the ground often resort to human rights abuses, which is being seen. Now, is that a state policy? I don't think so. I do believe the state per se is not, you know, does not condone in any shape or form human rights abuses. But the fact is, it doesn't have effective control. So, you know, I think the international community's response, rather than just pointing fingers at the human rights abuses, is saying, okay, let's work together. How can we, you know, enable you to better, you know, ensure that human rights are respected?
Okay. What about the religion that is practiced in Nepal and the role of the monarchy? When some of the royal family members were murdered by another member, I remember there was I didn't quite understand the response of the population. Maybe they had certain fears, or I wasn't quite sure how all that played into religion, the death of a monarch or the murder of one member of the family by another. Maybe, I don't know if you can address that or not, but what is the position of the monarchy in relation to religion and power and God and gods?
That's a very good and valid question indeed. Yes, religion has surfaced as one of the primary reasons, both as a cause for the insurgency, and how Nepalese both behave in its political system. On the insurgency cause for the insurgency side, what we are looking at is a state that is about 86, 87, up to 90%, in earlier years, Hindus. And it's a Hindu state by constitution. But beneath this picture of unity is some severe divisions, which has been cause of the insurgency and also exploited by the insurgency leaders. For example, you got 60 recognized castes and ethnic groups. Only about 54% of that recognized caste system are actually embraced by the caste system, and more than one third, about 36%, are classified as ethnic or tribal groups. Muggers, Tharus, Newars, Tamangs, which means they don't even fall into the division of the caste system. And it's a very rigid hierarchy. Most of the government posts, the army, the positions of power are generally held by the top caste, the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas. Although since 1990 or even previous to that time, there was gradual integration of other castes and groups into positions of power. But of course, the transition wasn't quick enough or wasn't done in an organized manner, which has led to this crisis.
Well, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, it's been estimated something like 10,000 people have been killed since the insurgency got going in 1996. As the caller mentions, the government has been accused of human rights abuses. The insurgents have been accused of human rights abuses. And there was concern because Nepal is in a place where there is potential for conflict. It is sandwiched in between India and China up on the north eastern border of India, between India and China. So there seem, on the face of it, to be reasons why the rest of the world should get involved and see if there's something that we could do to try to settle this. What are the potential dangers here of this conflict, not only for Nepal, but for the region?
I think there's some strategic issues at stake here, for U.S. Foreign policy in the region. Like you correctly mentioned, it is straddling two emerging Asian powers that are of great interest to the United States in various shapes and forms, India and China. Now, state failure in an area that straddles, in a strategic area that straddles these two countries could lead to a number of things. Any spillover effects in the region, which is, by the way, already rife with a deadly combination of ethnic and separatist movements, religious fundamentalism, bitter territorial disputes, including nuclear competition. It all leads to very explosive scenarios. And how that might come into form, the state failure, is, I think, the Nepali government, in desperation, would seek outside help, will be looking to India, to China, and to countries in the West for assistance in tackling this problem. When it does so, that might heighten bitter competition for influence in the region, which probably the U.S. doesn't want. Of course, we do, in the U.S., we don't want India and China competing for influence over Nepal, which in so many ways hasn't been brought face to face. It has provided a sort of buffer, if you like. Mm. The other side to this is a desperate Nepali government could end up allowing a lot of demons to emerge, And that is more true in a post-September 11 world, where, you know, any failed state may become the host to international terrorist groups. And, you know, lastly, and which is more an ideological reason, but a responsible international community, a leader of the world, the United States, cannot ignore the social, political, and humanitarian disquiet that has been created by the Maoist problem.
Hmm. Well, you point to something that I'm sure would be a concern for the governments of India and China. I'm sure that neither of them would want to have a failed state on their border. Has the government of India or the government of China had any involvement in this or tried to involve themselves in Nepal in a constructive way?
There has been entreaties from the Nepali side, and so far both, you know, China has kept a distance from the Nepali problem for various reasons. I think it believes its focus on economic transformation and not to be involved or bogged down on these sort of problems. India is more engaged, more so by territory and socio-economic and political commonalities that Nepal and India shares. In the beginning of the problem, India's position was more towards allowing Nepal to take care of its own problems. And as increasingly, as the Maoists have developed relations across the borders with Maoists and other revolutionary movements in the Indian border, concerns in New Delhi capital has heightened, you know, post that. There is a history of cooperation between the Nepalese and Indian government in mostly in economic, but also in military side of the house because of the history of the Gurkhas, of the British Raj, and Nepalese serving within the British Raj, and then post after 1947, after the independence of India, when Gurkhas continue to serve in the Indian Army now. So because of that, there had been exchange of training to you know, the military relations and ties are somewhat closer than the political in many ways.
We are just a little bit past the midpoint of this first hour of Focus 580, talking about Nepal with Sudhir Mahara. He studied at Georgetown University, where he got a master's degree in security and strategic studies. He's also educated in Nepal, where he grew up, and also at the Royal Military Academy at Sandhurst in the UK. He currently has a scholar in residence at the Center for National Security Law at the University of Virginia Law School, was also consultant to the International Justice Mission Anti-Human Trafficking Project in India, served in the Royal Nepalese Army, and also works as a consultant with the military consulting firm Blue Force LLC, which is located in Hampton, Virginia. Questions certainly welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Perhaps we might talk a little bit about the problem of people who have been driven out of their homes as a result of the fighting. I believe that I read that particularly this was a problem for a neighboring country, for Bhutan, although their borders don't touch, Nepal and Bhutan. It's not all that far from the eastern border of Nepal to Bhutan. Has that also been a problem for India, for China, for people being having to leave not only their homes but actually leaving the country?
This is a very interesting question indeed. As we mentioned, you talk about the resource competition in Nepal. That problem has been in Nepal just because of its territory, the sort of territory it has. Part of the shortfall was covered by a large portion of laborers migrating into India for work. That continued even before the insurgency. Nepal shares an open border with India, and both people and goods in many forms flow freely between the two countries. Now, you know, we've got 10,000 people killed and a lot more injured, and then a huge number, you know, numbering up to 500,000 perhaps displaced. Now, there is no way this figure can be substantiated, because this would be in addition to the traditional migrant laborers. What's happening in the hills of Nepal is a lot of people, for fear of forced recruitment into the insurgency, have fled their homes, especially men of fighting age, anybody above 16 to 50 years, have either been displaced inside the country or have migrated to India. And the statistics show from 100,000 to 500,000 to some analysts even mentioning perhaps higher numbers. And for a small country like Nepal, that is a very worrying situation.
One of the perhaps the most important sources of income for the country for a long time has been tourism. As you mentioned, the place has great natural beauty. It is the location of Mount Everest. People do go there for trekking and hiking and so forth. And apparently people still, maybe not as many as in the past, but people, outsiders, still have continued to go there for that reason. Has there been any concern that the insurgents might actually target foreign tourists who go there?
Looking at the actual cases so far, there hasn't been major cases of tourists being attacked. Although they've been extorted, they have to pay taxes, and they've been made to pay taxes, and some have been roughed up. But there hasn't been any instance, and there's been a few cases of not necessarily tourists, but of foreigners being abducted, although released at a later stage. So, yes, the tourism industry, though, just by because of the insurgency, has been devastated. It was a major national industry that, you know, adds to the Nepal's already dire economic problems. The other economic crisis that has come, or the industry, major industry that has been affected, is again the labor industry, the migrant labor industry. Nepal began participating again in the 1990s in the global labor market, with people migrating to the Middle East, to places in Asia, and even to places in the West as labor. What that provided the state or the country was a lot of remittance of these earnings going back to family members in Nepal. Since the incident in Iraq, where 12 Nepalese workers were murdered by a terrorist group, the labor or the migrant labor industry also, both because of knee-jerk policies on the government side and because of public opinion and perceptions about migrant labor, has started declining. And thus the remittance that came into and provided a safety valve for the Nepalese economy is being devastated.
Do you have some feeling about how much of the country now is controlled by the insurgents?
And that is, again, a most debated issue. And sitting in the boardrooms or living rooms of the West, there is a perception that Maoists are increasingly holding more and more of the territory. You know, some going as high as three-fifths of the total territory in Nepal. I take a somewhat different view on that. The terrain itself, you know, is so difficult. As we mentioned, you're looking at one-third Himalayas, and then, you know, about another one-third of that being hilly. And by hilly, we're not talking Virginia rolling hills, but mountains above 5,000 feet. So to actually physically hold that sort of ground, a government requires a lot more troops, at least, you know, 20, 30 or 50 times more troops to put on the ground. So absence of government armed forces, you know, in any area is being considered under total Maoist control. That might be true in some ways, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the government can go back and retake that territory whenever, in whatever shape or form it wants to.
We have another caller here to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. Someone listening in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yes. Is the insurgency worse in the Terai or in the mountains?
It's worse in the mountains, but there are certain areas of the Terai that have been severely affected recently.
I wonder what the effect on the higher education system, such as Tribhuvan University and the Institute of Agriculture in the Terai.
Two ways to answer that question. Of course, a lot of the recruitment and the ideological input do come in from the universities and student leaders participating in such such venues. More than the university level education, I think what has affected most is a school, a senior secondary level education in the mountains, where there have been a lot of instances of forced recruitment by the Maoist of school going children, you know, 16, 17 year old kids going to senior secondary school. And that has also been a matter of grave concern for the international community, and that's got a lot of media attention also.
Well, again, other questions are welcome. We have about 15 minutes left in this first hour of the show. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Is there, what sort of evidence is there that the insurgents are receiving assistance from outside of the country, and if they are, where is that coming from?
The insurgents have various alliances or memberships. You know, on the international side, the most visible being RIM, a Revolutionary International Movement, based in London. Recently, they formed a coordination committee called the Committee of the Maoist Parties and Organizations of South Asia, which has this virtually unpronounceable acronym. But cut a long story short, it is formed of some 10 or 11 revolutionary movements, you know, United Liberation Front of Assam, Maoist Communist Center in Bihar, People's War Group, you know, North Bengal Liberation Front, such organizations. And what they have done is they've cooperated in training each other's cadres in various arts of war, to providing safe havens when they cross the border and want to hide, or provided even medical, you know, recovery, and for instance, some Maoist cadre, when injured in battle in Nepal, have been known to slip across the border and live with these Maoist groups in safe areas in India for recovery. So that's the sort of cooperation that is known.
Well, what has, maybe we can talk a little bit more about what sort of assistance have outside parties, other nations essentially, tried to render to Nepal to get involved in this conflict? Or has there been all that much? I mean, we talked earlier about the fact, particularly asked about India and China, and you talked about the fact that perhaps there are more ties, when you talk about ties between Nepal and the outside, there are ties between the military, the Nepalese military and other militaries. But has there been much government-to-government sort of involvement in this conflict or attempts to become involved in, again, in a constructive way in the conflict?
Yes. The three major nations that have been involved in assisting the Nepali government is the U.S. government, the British government, and the Indian government. I think there was expectation on the Nepalese side for the U.S. Government to take the lead in coordinating the foreign assistance effort sometimes with varying degrees of response from the U.S. government, sometimes quite energetic and sometimes lukewarm, which changes according to various issues. When there is a human rights incident that is on the international media less, and then when there is a serious concern about state failure in Nepal more. The U.S. government so far has, or assistance so far, in addition to the traditional USAID or development assistance that goes, has been an added $20 million, and in fact $25 million or so, the first package being $20 million, in equipment and some arms also. The Indian government has provided some military arms, weapons, and equipment to the army and some training assistance. But these are, I wouldn't necessarily say a huge response, but rather an extension of the pre-existing ties that Nepal and the U.S. government, Nepal and the Indian government, and Nepal and the British government have shared.
We have someone else to talk with. Let's go to another caller, someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Good afternoon or good morning. Thank you very much for speaking on this. I just had some general social questions. I only know enough to know I don't know that much about Nepal. Do they follow the Indian sort of caste hierarchies? Is there great socioeconomic division among the Nepalese, or is everybody fairly? Are the economics fairly distributed, or is it more like Pakistan, where 90% of the land is owned by 1% of the population? Because I think, when I hear about a quote Maoist group, those are very hard to export. Usually, they require some major dissent within, and I'm just curious if there is this economic hierarchy of some sort. So if you could speak on that, that would be great. Thank you.
Thank you for the question. And you are quite right about the socioeconomic division. Yes, there is. To address the caste issue, It is aligned according to, very close to the Indian caste system, the four major castes, the Brahmins and Kshatriyas being at the top, and then the Vaishyas and the Sudras at the bottom. And like I mentioned, the ethnic groups do not even fall within the caste systems, but are as tribal. So there is division there. There has been a dominant feudal system, both in terms of land and in terms of it is a monarchy, and how the monarchy ruled. There is an uneven division of resources, not only in terms of the society, but also in how the country is laid out. For instance, most of the government resources, the government offices, the buildings, to whatever you have, is concentrated in the major cities, especially Kathmandu, and then a few cities around in areas. And the hills are pretty much have been left on their own. Of course, that situation has been worsened by the insurgency, because development assistance, government programs are not able to go into the mountains, even if they want to.
Well, again, other questions are welcome. We do have about 7-8 minutes left in this part of Focus 580-333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana listeners. We do also have the toll-free line, and so if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number. That is 800-222-9455, and here locally, 333-9455. What could now – we've talked about what the attempts that have been made outside governments to try to be involved. What do you think should happen now?
My wish list. I think there is understanding in the leadership, the Nepalese leadership, about both the scope and consequences of this crisis, of where it would lead to. There are personal or group stakes at concern. But there is the collective stake of the whole, you know, country's well-being and then the collective destiny of the 24 million people that live in this country. What has been the biggest shortfall, in my opinion, in responding to this crisis is a leadership vacuum in being able to coordinate a response that integrates all elements of national power, economic, social, political, psychological, and of the civil society, into seeing what sort of a response is needed so that the Maoist insurgents are brought into mainstream politics and asked to give up violent opposition and come into electoral opposition. This is understood at all levels of government or all levels of Nepalese society leadership. What lacks is a clear vision, focus, and both resources in terms of technical resources and in terms of know-how resources in putting such a plan together. And I think this is where the international community, and especially powerful states like the U.S. that has a strategic interest in a region like Nepal, helping in assisting the Nepalese leadership put together. Once that put, you know, again, you're not going to, you can't expect a rapid reform or a change overnight. But I think that could possibly, you know, lead to a certain ceasefire, followed by confidence-building measures, and eventually socio-economic, you know, reforms and transformation.
Mm-hmm. The from what I have read, people who have followed the conflict have said that they thought that both sides could continue to keep fighting, but that neither side was strong enough to achieve a complete military victory over the other. Have also with the qualification, though, that it does seem that over time the military strength of the insurgency has grown from what it was when it started out. But do you feel that it is essentially true that for the moment and for the foreseeable future that the military situation, the military conflict, is at stalemate?
You know, yes and no. You know, and then you know again, you know, to answer that the government or the security forces are perceived to have lost when they don't win, and rebels are perceived to have won when they don't lose. Again, you know, really looking at the strategic military balance. I mean, Maoists have about 29. Battalions. You know, it started with, you know, in 2002 when they were, or 2001 when they started offensive military operations, they had about 4 battalions. Now the strength has been stretched to 29, with not full, you know, a battalion or a Maoist battalion being about 300 in strength. In sheer strategic balance, looking force to force, that is not really a military force to contend with. But why is it posing such a threat to the state then? Comes the question. And the answer to that is because they have the ability of not being found. They have the ability of concentrating and attacking certain positions that are isolated where government forces are not present or are present in very small numbers or are vulnerable. And thirdly, is they have the means, the use of terror, of coercion, which is not an option, you know, at least that sort of widespread use of terror is not an option for a democratic state. And that is what basically amplifies the perception of Maoist military power. You know, weapon to weapon, man to man, you know, a pure strategic balance isn't there. And I think, you know, if the Nepalese government is to respond, you know, militarily, if they're, you know, looking at the, if they're to think about its military response, that is the problems they need to get their hands around.
The United States apparently has officially classified the insurgency as a terrorist group. Do you think that that is correct? Or is it in fact correct and yet a rather incomplete understanding of what it is that's going on there?
A very complex question indeed, David, here. Two things. The insurgency started with you know, understandably legitimate concerns. You know, we talked about the population, the resource competition, the feudal society, the missed opportunities of the politicians since 1990 to bring the country back. You know, when democracy was basically granted, so all those opportunities were squandered. So it started under legitimate enough concerns, but I don't think it justified a violent opposition. And since then, I think the means sought by the insurgents have been terrorist in nature. And that is, I think, the crux of the problem. So the U.S. positioning, I think, should be used more as a tool rather than a position. If the Maoists choose to continue on the path of terror, then it should be classified as a terrorist organization. If they choose to come to the tables, negotiating tables, where a settlement might be reached and can be incorporated into mainstream Nepali politics, then they should be given the chance to do so.
Pardon me for jumping in on you there, but I'm simply going to have to do that because we've come to the end of the time and we'll have to close out. I want to thank you very much for giving us your time today. We certainly appreciate it.
Thank you very much, David.
Our guest, Sudhir Mahara, he is part of the consulting firm of Blue Force LLC, which does consulting for the Department of Defense, as well as others. He's also a scholar in residence at the Center for National Security Law at University of Virginia.